Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. We are now into the second year of the Trump administration, and the last year has been filled with ups and downs, important victories, successful holding campaigns, and painful defeats. We've learned a lot, but there's always more to learn and more to be done. In this now weekly series, we talk with organizers, agitators, and educators, not only about how to resist, but how to build a better world. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host. Hadi Barkan became a household name when he was spotted over and over again at protests against healthcare cuts in Washington during the fight for the Affordable Care Act and then against the Republican tax cut bill, which included cuts to healthcare programs. For Barkan, a longtime organizer diagnosed in 2016 with ALS, the fight for healthcare had become very personal. We sat down last week in Baltimore at the Congressional Progressive Caucus Strategy Summit, where Barkan, who masterminded the Fed Up campaign as well as being central to the healthcare struggle, was being honored with the Tim Carpenter Advocate of the Year Award.
My name is Hadi Barkan. I'm 34 years old. I live in Santa Barbara, California, with my wife and toddler, and I work at the Center for Popular Democracy.
So you kind of got famous this year sitting next to a certain someone on a plane.
Yeah.
And so let's go back to that for a minute, because that was how many months ago now?
That was December 7th, I think.
Wow, it was only 3 months ago.
Yeah. It's been an intense.
It feels like it was a year ago. Wow. Yeah, I guess take us back to that moment for a second.
Left Congress 2 days earlier, yeah. Where we were protesting the tax bill. I barely got to the airport on time. My friend who was picking me up was really late. I got to the front of the line at the gate and then overheard a friend who shares your ancestry, Liz Jaffe, talking on the phone about Twitter with a candidate of hers. And I'd never met her and didn't know her, but I kind of introduced myself. And no one said I'd had a Twitter moment the day before when Ben Wickler's video of me getting arrested had gotten like 4,000 or 5,000 views. And we were chatting, and she said, well, you know, Jeff Flake's on this plane. So it was a good opportunity to practice some bird dogging, which in some ways I'd been preparing my whole life for, with speech and debate and theater and journalism, you know, watching these Stone and Douglas kids. Mm-hmm. Yeah. From Florida, yeah. It's such a vivid reminder to me of how important funding for speech and debate and journalism and theater are, because that's where they got so good. So
I love it.
It was just a good opportunity to try to hold his feet to the fire, even though it didn't work.
Yeah. Jeff Flake, of all people, too, because he sort of wants to have it both ways. Right.
Totally. Wants to get the credit for being thoughtful and independent. And what's the word he loves to use? Not dignity, but like decency. Decency.
Wasn't that what Edward R. Murrow used on Joe McCarthy?
Yeah, that's right.
Have you no sense of decency,
yeah,
sir?
Yeah. Although I think it was a Army general, not Murray.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. It is interesting, because I think McCarthy is one of the sort of precursors of Trump and Trumpism.
Totally.
You know, we sort of had the one fight that was supposedly to save healthcare, and then they've just been backdoor cutting it ever since.
That's right.
And
makes sense. They control the government. In a functioning democracy, they probably should get to implement their agenda, and then the voters in the polls should be able to pass judgment on it. I think the system we have, where the governing party doesn't get to implement its agenda, is really counterproductive for democracy. Yeah. It confuses everybody. So, like, we blame Obama and the Democrats because they didn't, you know, save the economy or do X or Y, but it was the Republicans who were obstructing. It would be much better if there was a clear connection between governance and outcomes.
It's interesting. You should talk to some of the European folks who are here.
That's true. They may be less happy with it.
Yeah, it's tough, right? Because not only that, but then you get, again, they implement parts of the agenda, and we sort of hear that it's a tax bill, and you hear that people are getting, you know, maybe getting something back in their taxes, or if you're a freelancer like me, your taxes are going up. But, like, we don't hear about the other parts of that quite as much.
Yeah.
Now it's still referred to over and over as the tax bill.
So one thing that I'm going to be doing this year with Liz, Jaff, and Winnie Wong is launching this Be a Hero Fund that will try to raise money and spend it to win House seats for progressives away from Republican motivate voters and volunteers, and with a focus precisely on the tax and the health care bill, and on highlighting for the American people how and why this bill is bad for them and good for the plutocrats.
Looking back on all of this year, I mean, I suppose things could have been worse on some fronts, but it was still a mess. But what do you think we've learned in the last year that we can think about going forward about sort of both, like, stopping that agenda, but also implementing a positive vision, implementing an actually functional healthcare system?
Maybe three things to start with. By the time I'm done, maybe I'll have more. But one is that how unpredictable the future is, and that's on a social level and a personal level. I was diagnosed with this disease out of nowhere 3 weeks before the presidential election. You know, before then, Rachel and I were the happiest, luckiest people we knew. We had a healthy baby boy. We each had these fulfilling jobs. We lived in paradisical Santa Barbara. Like, literally, the number one thing I worried about in the weeks before my diagnosis, I remember, was that there was grass growing up in my plants that I had planted, and I couldn't for the life of me get rid of it. And it was so infuriating. You know, like, the future was bright. Democrats were going to win the presidency. We'd finally get control of the Supreme Court after 40 years. My son and I, like, so, you know, on the personal level, it's unpredictable. And then 3 weeks later, Donald Trump wins the election. So one is, we should stop making predictions.
Two, I'll second that one.
Two is, and we have to appreciate what we have and the moment we're in, and not only live in the future. As to resistance, I think it's proven more effective than I think many people thought possible. You know, Chuck Schumer and the like were all ready to capitulate on everything until what the fuck, Chuck, protests started popping up in Park Slope.
Yep.
And we actually were able to gum up the work to block a bunch. I mean, ultimately, he's really passed, enacted only one significant piece of legislation, which is not terrible for unified government. You know, I don't think they're going to get anything else. They don't have any good reconciliation instructions, and, you know, it's an election year. We'll see about this bank lobbyist Dodd-Frank rollback, where the Democrats are being traitors, which brings me to the third point, which is that we have a lot of house cleaning to do. The Dems are still way too in the pocket of Wall Street. You know, Elizabeth Warren's speech yesterday on the House floor was really fantastic. It's just so embarrassing and infuriating to see the D-Trip endorse a union buster in Houston, and all these Dems support rolling back. It's like, who among the American people is clamoring for reducing the regulations on? It's crazy.
Bankers are.
Bankers. So those are my three lessons.
Yeah, it was really striking this morning, because we're here at this thing to hear, you know, Elizabeth Warren speak about that and just say, sort of, yeah, 16 Democrats, including the vice presidential nominee.
Oh, my God. I remember the day that he was chosen, that when Tim Kaine was picked, everyone was bellyaching. It had been our fault. We had focused on the platform. We'd all worked so hard to get various good things in the platform. We knew for months that Tim Kaine was the number one candidate.
Yeah.
And none of us, I wrote a long email about this way back when. Are you on it?
No.
I can forward it if you want,
yeah.
But it's such a, we could have easily launched campaigns documenting Kaine's sins on a whole array of things,
yeah.
And I said that he's an unacceptable choice. Well, we didn't. And we got him, and, you know, it's a perfect example of what happens if we let the establishment party kind of operate without our voices included in the conversation. They play it safe, pick the conservative white dude from Virginia. I mean, if she had picked...
Spanish.
Yeah, exactly. If she had picked Warren, if she had picked Bernie... If she picks Tom Perez, instead we get this douchebag who now votes for deregulating the bank. He's like Joe Lieberman. It's the same thing.
I try to forget about Joe
Lieberman,
you know.
Well, we need to primary Chuck Schumer. Unfortunately, it's still many years away. We need to get rid of these guys like Kaine. Mark Warner. It's really outrageous. I mean, it's one thing for Joe Manchin or Doug Jones. We can debate whether in deep red America.
Although after the last couple of weeks in West Virginia,
exactly.
We can debate whether that's what deep red
but
America
is. But in Virginia, in, you know, Montana, where there's demand for populism. Remember when Tester was elected in the wave in 06? Everyone was so excited he was this cowboy populist.
Wow.
No fucking way.
These things happen,
yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting because, like, after a year of, like you said, it goes back to people showing up outside of Chuck Schumer's house and saying, like,
yeah,
you still see it. It's been
totally.
A year. Of mass protests in the streets, at the airports, at Congress, people getting arrested over and over again at Congress.
Yeah, yeah.
And they still, this is still the vote they're going to stick their
necks out on. Yep, it's crazy. It's like Obama, the number one thing he fought hardest for after healthcare was TPP. That's how he spent his final year in office. Fighting for TPP. And then you wonder why Ohio goes for Trump. So we got a lot of work to do.
So you already mentioned one thing that you're working on this year. What should we be talking about? Like you mentioned the platform and fighting to get good things in the platform. What do you want to hear people saying that they will do? Like if they get
if I had another 5 years of health, the campaign I would want to run would be a guaranteed good jobs campaign. I mean, I think we could run it now, leading up to 2020. be a great campaign to say, if you can't find good work in the private sector, we're not going to give you unemployment benefits. We're going to give you employment, and we're going to put you to work cleaning the streets, rebuilding our infrastructure, taking care of old people or young people, you know, like writing plays, making music. Like, there's so much good to be done in the world. We can afford it for free. I mean, $1.5 trillion for the biggest corporations, you know, $80 billion because for military when John McCain sneezes and wants to increase the appropriation for the military budget, you can conjure up $80 billion a year, which is basically what it would cost, I think, child care. I don't remember, but, you know, so that's the campaign I would want to run. A good jobs guarantee that would allow us to combat racial, gender, economic inequality. It would allow us to invest in the country, be a populist vision that people could run on in every district in the country. It's much more easy to explain and understand than like fed up, which is esoteric, hard for people to understand. What is the Fed? How do interest rates work? You know. So if I had one campaign to run, it would be that one. And I hope that Bernie does it. Maybe I'll be able to convince his people, and we can make an issue in 2020.
How can people keep up with you? Your work.
Twitter is good, Adi Barkin, and I'll be keeping folks updated on the political electoral work, on the resistance work. Maybe I'll be going, we'll see, to Arizona to or Oklahoma to join the teachers, which will be lots of fun, and people can get involved and need to get involved every day from now till November.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Fayebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.